So welcome back to everyone. If you could take a seat, we're going to move on to our next module. This will be another virtual mini module. Welcome to Dr. Dave O'Malley from The Ohio State University. Congratulations. I see you pulverized the Ohio State there today, but next week you're going to be against Penn State. How do you think you're going to do there, Dave?
Oh, I tell you, it's going to be another tough match. Penn State and Ohio State have had some great battles over the years. So I was a good test for the first half today, but the Ohio State offense pulled it out, it looked like.
I've been hearing some interesting stories about these virtual people, dogs running by that we didn't know about. Actually, one person actually presented to us, I didn't realize, in their jammies. Anyhow, little secrets there. So here to talk about really one of the great advances, I think, in oncology, even in medicine in general, the use of PARP inhibitors that was really pioneered in ovarian cancer. We've been talking about it today, Dave. We talked about it in our breast cancer session, really exciting data in prostate cancer. We'll talk about it in pancreatic cancer yesterday, but you all really had the lead, and we're going to focus on that for the next few minutes, talking about where these agents fit in today and where things might be heading in the future. And of course, mainly we're going to talk about primary maintenance setting and the upfront setting, but in the end, I want to get your take a little bit about some of the things that have been going on, particularly as it relates to the FDA pulling back approvals in the very later line setting. But we're going to focus on primary maintenance to start with. And we've asked you to review some of the key data that continues to come out about these really revolutionary studies. But before you get into that, I just want to get your thoughts about really the workup of patients with ovarian cancer. It's really evolved a lot over the last few years, really trying to make sure you don't miss anyone who might benefit from PARP inhibitors. You have the issue of germline testing, somatic testing. Right now, Dave, everybody who walks through the door with primary ovarian cancer, are they going to be evaluated, and how?
Everybody gets genomic testing. Everybody gets genomic testing. So we need to identify those patients who are going to benefit not only by PARP inhibitors, but also cascade testing for families. When we look at the actual incidence of ovarian cancer, it's going down because of the testing and the prophylactic surgery we're doing. In addition, the molecular testing, the somatic testing of the primary tumor or metastatic, but of the somatic testing, looking for HRD. And then upon recurrence, I test and look for next generation sequencing, looking for those targetable molecular characteristics. But in the upfront, everybody gets germline, ASCO, SGO, everything, NCCN said it. And then as well as everybody should have the somatic testing for HRD.
So let's take a look at the data, and then we'll chat a little bit about sort of what it means in terms of patient care. So you want to go ahead?
Yeah, great. And thank you for having me. You know, because I'm going to really limit this to about 6 minutes, we really had to spend our time in the upfront first line, which is, as you'll see, is the most important. But just as a quick background, we really haven't changed this paradigm except for the maintenance, that big square in the middle. So it's still the carboplatin paclitaxel doublet plus or minus Bev. So if you have to make that decision about Bev in that first line setting, and again, we're not going to really talk about the recurrent setting in this presentation, but we will in our discussion. So once you've completed that platinum doublet plus or minus Bev, then you have to really talk about, are you going to utilize a maintenance therapy? But really that first question on Bev comes down to this GOG-218. There was another European trial called ICON-7. And you see with Bev continued, not only with the chemotherapy, but beyond for 1 year, that you had about a 6-month improvement in progression-free survival with a hazard, a hazard ratio about 0.6. So modest. And you see those curves really come together after you've completed the Bev. So that's our baseline where we're really looking at Bev in itself. Now, when we really look at the amount of trials, prospective trials, which have been done, you see here there's 6 trials that have read out. We're going to really concentrate on those 4 trials in the upfront setting. All of them were maintenance therapy. All of them were maintenance therapy. All of them included included PARP as part of that treatment. And Paolo included Bev in the treatment while the other three had placebo in the maintenance or standard arm. I said treatment, I meant standard arm, but also treatment arm. So the Paolo was PARP, elaborate plus Bev versus Bev, while all the others were PARP versus placebo. Now, we talked about this in the opening question. Every patient should have homologous recombination deficiency tested in advanced ovarian cancer. There's really two on the market which have been utilized in their prospective trials. There's other on the markets which are commercially available. But the two are Miramar Choice and Foundation One LOH testing. Slightly different, but probably more similar than different, where Miramar Choice is really look at three different aspects to include loss of heterozygosity, while Foundation One is just loss of heterozygosity. And using Paolo One as the example, you see, and this is pretty consistent across trials, about 30% will be BRCA, that includes germline and somatic. Another about 20% will be BRCA wild type, but HRD positive. And then we have about 35%, which will be HRD test negative, also sometimes called homologous recombination proficient, and those about another 15 to 20, which will be unknown. So what's occurred here this year? Well, at ESMO, Paul DiSusto updated the 7-year survival of Solo One. Solo One's BRCA patients only, PARP versus placebo, and you see the widening of those confidence of those curves. But really, the placebo arm is doing really well when we look at BRCA patients. To me, the more impressive is the time to first subsequent therapy. So to this meetings, these patients have not yet been treated. You look at that 3 to 4 years, those curves really don't change much. But now look it out to 7 years. 45% of patients on PARP inhibitor have not recurred with a BRCA mutation versus 20% in the placebo. We're curing 45% of upfront advanced cases. And how about Paolo One? This is the elaborate plus Bev versus Bev. This is updated survival also presented by Isabel Rey-Cocard at ESMO. And we see, again, clear differences between those curves in the overall survival bins of HRD. So that shows both BRCA and HRD positive. But what else was included? The updated progression-free survival, 19% versus 45%, who have not recurred at 5 years. Again, advanced ovarian cancer here, which have not recurred at 5 years. We look at the subgroup analysis a little bit more granular, but you see in the HRD test negative, there was no advantage of PARP when you compare it to Bev, and actually Bev had the advantage. So the other upfront trial, which we've been waiting for, is Athena Mono, and this was presented by Brad Monk. And Athena Mono looked at rucaparib versus placebo. And it's a complex trial, but the two arms with regards to rucaparib versus placebo at a 4-to-1 randomization were presented at ASCO by Brad. The primary endpoint was HRD, and you see here a hazard ratio of 0.47 when we're comparing rucaparib versus placebo, and clear separation of the curves that persist. And remembering that this treatment was 2 years of maintenance therapy. And how about in the intent to treat population? Again, 50% improvement, hazard ratio 0.5, clear separation of curves, as well as into the tails of the curve. And when we really compare all the prospective trials, and I've broken these down by BRCA here, you're looking at hazard ratios of 0.3 to 0.4, and I've included the GOG-218 data as the comparison on the left. Clearly, PARP in the first-line setting of BRCA patient is the standard of care at this point. And how about BRCA wild-type HRD? Once again, clear delineation of those curves, of those curves in these patient populations. And then in the HRD test negative, we see positive results, though much more modest. And we would compare it against the Bev comparator arm and Paolo in the lower right corner. We really don't see any separation in those arms. So again, maintenance therapy is important in all of these treatment populations. And this is really a summary slide for the audience, which goes over each one of those results I've just discussed. you have to take that with a bit of a grain of salt, because they will have different primary outcomes of BICR versus investigator. Now, you have to keep in mind, these are oral therapies daily. This is not hormonal maintenance therapy. These are treatment, which I'm sure you discussed earlier today. Very consistent discontinuation ratio, about 10 to 20%. But dose reductions of about half the patients, maybe slightly better in olaparib, maybe slightly worse in niraparib. But again, very important to keep in toxicity. So where are we, Neil? Basically, we have the first choice. Are you going to use Bev in the first line with your platinum doublet with paclitaxel? If you use Bev, okay, we're going on the lower right. In that case, if you have HRD positive, you're going to add olaparib. If your HR test negative, then you're going to continue the Bev. If you don't utilize Bev in the upfront setting as a BRCA patient, then you're going to add the PARP inhibitor. HRD, PARP inhibitor. HRD test negative, in that case, I would recommend a PARP inhibitor because the clear improvement in the progression-free survival. Now, there are four completed ongoing trials. Three of the four have utilized Bev. The other Athenum combo did not allow Bev. And these will all read out in the next year or two, really changing the landscape. So what do I do in the upfront setting? It's no longer should you use maintenance therapy. It's which maintenance therapy are you going to use, PARP versus Bev versus both. And let's start talking curative intent here. We are curing half the patients if we use the proper therapy. But biomarker is the key, but as well as the management of toxicity. We have to continue to get better here. So thank you very much for your time. I'm sorry I went a minute or so over, and I'm happy to take any questions.
So just to pick up on a lot of the issues that you talked about and also practical implications. You used the word cure a few times, and we were talking this morning earlier that, you know, the adjuvant tamoxifen trials, people are very surprised because even after they stopped the tamoxifen, the curve stayed apart. It looks a lot like what you saw there. What's your thought about the likelihood of delayed recurrence, or do you think these people really are cured?
What's really amazing is if we look at the curves really starting about year four at maintenance therapy, you have very few patients fall off. Now, what we don't know is those patients who have subsequent therapy versus progression-free survival that are an event, is that event because they potentially died of other causes? So we don't know the reasons those patients are having an event. So really, if you make it to year four or five, most likely you are cured of your advanced ovarian cancer. And can you have a late recurrence? Absolutely. But you see how flat those tails of the curve are, both in the placebo arm and in the treatment arms, or the experimental arms, I should say.
Yeah, we did a satellite at ASCO, and Katie Moore, the principal investigator, solo one, was there, and she was talking about how she felt when she first saw those curves. They were shocked. They didn't expect it to look like that. Really one of the great stories, I think, in oncology. So let's start dissecting this out from a practical point of view. I'm going to put out a bunch of practical issues and sort of see how you think it through. And we'll put aside the Athena for 1 second. We'll get into that in a minute. But, you know, prior to the Athena, we had mainly a niraparib and olaparib to consider, a couple different issues there that we want to get into. So first of all, when you see a patient with primary ovarian cancer, neoadjuvant versus not, how do you determine that?
Well, really, it's based on the disease burden and the functional status of the patient. If they have disease in their chest, they have significant portohepatic disease, in those scenarios, I'm used to almost always good neoadjuvant. If they've had recent DVTs, PEs, and the risk of surgery is higher, those patients get neoadjuvant. If they just have ascites without pleural effusions, you know, I'm going to have a conversation with those patients, because if you can dry up that ascites, you know, they're going to do much better perioperatively.
So you also brought up the issue of Bev. So Bev or not in the neoadjuvant setting and in the post-op setting?
You know, it's interesting because I get asked that all the time. You know, I will, if they have large volume ascites, I'll tend to utilize Bev. Now, the official label of Bev is after attempted surgical resection. So you know, if you stick a laparoscope in, is that attempted surgical resection? I would say it probably is, because you've decided not to move forward with a large exploratory laparotomy. So I will utilize it, particularly with large volume disease or very heavy disease burden. Typically, I though do reserve it to after surgery, and it's the second cycle after surgery. So I tend to use 3 to 4 cycles in the neoadjuvant setting. Often I use 4, 3 of them will have Bev, and then 3 to 4 afterwards. I basically utilize Bev in almost everybody because of the really interesting data from Apollo 1, looking at the amazing outcomes, even those patients that in the past were considered low risk.
So you're hoping you're going to get the PARP inhibitor on top of that, the Paola approach, which should apply based on your numbers to the majority of patients. What about the patients with BRCA mutations? Either, first of all, any difference in how you approach it, somatic versus germline? And then we have 2 agents that have proven benefit, SOLO-1 and olaparib, and PRIMO with niraparib. So which PARP, and how do you approach these patients?
Well, because I utilize so much bevacizumab in the upfront setting, the really indication is for olaparib. You know, there is some prospective data with niraparib, but I worry about the hypertension. So I use a lot more olaparib because of that reason. Exactly what I said, if I'm using Bev for almost all of my patients in the advanced ovarian cancer, and then the only PARP which is available right now is olaparib.
So in terms of course, there are studies looking at Bev plus niraparib, but we haven't seen the kind of mature data from Paola. What about duration of therapy? Interestingly, at least niraparib was given for 3 years, olaparib for 2 years. Do you follow that do you recommend following those durations when they're used?
Yeah, I do recommend it. I was one of the, I wasn't sure I was going to do it at the beginning, but you know, one of the things we're going to talk about is AML and MDS risk. I think really I stick with the label now. If it's niraparib, which I will utilize because there's patients who are not eligible for Bev or have too high risk of potential complications. And so in that scenario, if I'm using niraparib, it's 3 years. If I'm using olaparib, it's 2 years. I really stick with the label and what the prospective phase 3 trials have done.
And of course, a really controversial situation is the patient with a HR proficient tumor. Niraparib has data in that population. It's interesting, we were talking about prostate cancer earlier, and ironically, the trial in prostate cancer showed benefit in the HRP. Niraparib didn't show the benefit. So interesting that that's the way it played out in ovarian cancer. Do you use niraparib in those patients?
You know, I do if I didn't utilize Bev, because we don't have that HRD test negative or HRP patient, so I can't use a olaparib, so that's easy. Now, because I do utilize so much Bev, and Bev in those HRP patients is a really nice treatment and probably is very similar to a PARP, but if you're not going to utilize Bev, then absolutely use niraparib in that scenario.
So tolerability issues. First, we'll talk about sort of acute issues, which you all have really the most experience with as you see it getting diffused into these other cancers. So both in terms of side effects, GI toxicity, what do you see? Do you use preemptive medication? And then cytopenias, what type of cytopenias and how do you manage that?
So let's start with the GI side effects, because GI and fatigue are the two biggest things. So we encouraged to take it with food. Some people say a fatty meal, but really just with food. That seems to make a big difference. We give all of our patients, most of them already have antiemetics at home. So what's been utilized for them in the past will make sure they have those agents. I have patients that take an antiemetic each time they take their PARP. That's what they need to do. With regards to cytopenia, the class effect is anemia. So I watch the anemia very closely. I explain to patients they need blood transfusion. They may need dose reduction because of the anemia. You can also see other cytopenias more so in the with niraparib, especially the thrombocytopenia. So that's why we use the weights and plates. Patient less than 70 kilos or less than 150 platelets starting, making sure you're starting niraparib at 200 milligrams rather than 300 milligrams.
So I'm curious what you say to your patients about the potential risk of AML and MDS. Again, we've been talking about that today. You know, I've heard people say, well, there's an 8% risk of MDS because in the later line, one of the later line studies, that was what it was. But the control arm that just had chemo had 4%. So I think what I'm seeing is roughly a doubling obviously, if you've had a lot of chemotherapy, your risk of NDS is going to go up. Earlier, it looks like maybe we're not seeing as much. I'm just curious what you say to your patients about that risk in the primary maintenance setting.
Every patient I talk to about the risk of AML and MDS, but you're exactly right. We see doubling in the recurrent setting. But when we look at it in the first line setting, the risk is probably 1-2%, very similar, if not the same, as the background risk of somebody who's had platinum. But I say this is a risk. I counsel everybody. I'm very straight shooter when it comes to that, because it really is a potentially fatal diagnosis. But they also have that risk with platinum chemotherapy. So in the frontline setting, more to the ammunition that PARPs are best utilized in the frontline setting, though they have a role in the recurrent setting also. But my first choice is utilize the PARP early on.
Yeah, we actually had a real case presented of a patient who got AML with ovarian cancer and never had a PARP inhibitor, had extensive chemotherapy. Fortunately, the patient now is in remission with HMA venetoclax. So one other issue I wanted to bring up, and that is some, I think, pretty confusing stuff coming out of the FDA, at least confusing to me. Voluntary withdrawals of late line indication of PARP inhibitors has a lot of people, I think, somewhat confused. We mentioned the Athena Rucaparib study, which seemed to reproduce what we already been talking about. Germline patients, they also saw benefit in HRP, yet it didn't get an indication because of these concerns of what appears to be increasing mortality in the late line settings. Any comments on that? It seems like this relates more to monotherapy in the platinum-resistant population. You would assume they wouldn't be getting any benefit out of platinum-resistant patients to start with. Just curious, I'm sure your patients maybe even bring this up to you, about what's been going on with the FDA here.
Well, unfortunately, what was picked up in the lay press and even in the professional press, what was put out was not accurate. So what happened was they looked at the overall survival and they saw some crossing of those OS curves. And so when they looked at them, they said, well, when you compare the PARP inhibitor versus chemotherapy, you have patients potentially having a slightly worse overall survival. But this is a non-analytic, and they crossed one. If you had this in a positive trial, you would never say that that trial was positive. So those curves really come together. But what's interesting, and I'm not going to say I'm mad at the companies that pulled these because they were all voluntary polling, but you look at Rucaparib, it was based on Aerial 4. This was a trial which was dominated enrolled in patients outside the U.S. and Europe. And when you look at the patients who received Rucaparib, one half of them never received subsequent therapy, even if they're platinum sensitive. One half of them never received subsequent therapy, while 90% of the patients in the chemotherapy arm received a PARP inhibitor, 88 to be precise. So if you take patients, send them to hospice, and compare them to patients who you then treat with a PARP inhibitor, well, of course the survival is going to be better. So really, when you look at this data granularly, it is somewhat ridiculous we pulled these indications. Saying that, we should not be waiting to second, third, fourth line for treating a BRCA patient with a PARP. It has to be the first line. So it's a bit of a moot point, but it is a real concern that we're seeing these non-analytic endpoints with these far-reaching implications by our regulatory agencies in the U.S. and across the world.
So Dave, thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to move on. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.